This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Nicht warten, durchstarten mit Indeed. Beschleunige dein Recruiting jetzt auf indeed.com/julep. Mit einer Premium-Stellenanzeige wird dein Angebot ganz oben auf der Seite platziert. Für mehr Sichtbarkeit, damit du schneller die richtigen Mitarbeiter findest und einstellen kannst. Und das Beste, das alles funktioniert ohne monatliches Abo oder langfristige Verträge. Du zahlst nur für Ergebnisse. Sicher dir jetzt 75 Euro Guthaben auf eine Premium-Stellenanzeige auf indeed.com/julep. Es gelten die AGB.
Wir sind Theresa und
Nemo
und deshalb sind wir zu Shopify gewechselt.
Die Plattform, die wir vor Shopify verwendet haben, hat regelmäßig Updates gebraucht, die teilweise dazu geführt haben, dass der Shop nicht funktioniert hat.
Endlich macht unser Nemo-Boards-Shop dadurch auch auf dem Mobilgerät eine gute Figur. Und die Illustrationen auf den Boards kommen jetzt viel, viel klarer rüber, was uns ja auch wichtig ist und was unsere Marke auch ausmacht.
Starte deinen Test noch heute für 1 Euro pro Monat auf shopify.de/radio.
Hello, I'm James Kamarasamy. Thank you for downloading the BBC's World Tonight podcast for Wednesday, the 26th of February. President Trump says the EU was created to screw the United States at his first cabinet meeting since returning to the White House, one where he handed the floor to Elon Musk. We speak to one of the federal workers fired by Mr. Musk's Doge department and consider how Sir Keir Starmer should approach his meeting in the White House with a senior US and UK diplomat. We also hear about an unusual insight into the lives of Russians. Remember Henry Kelly, a former reporter on this programme, who went on to pastures more golden. And the poetry that tells us Merlin may not have been the magical wizard of folklore fame. You certainly can't accuse Donald Trump of hiding from the cameras. This evening, the press were allowed into the first meeting of his new cabinet, not for a few brief minutes of smiles and pleasantries, but for an hour or so long session of questions and answers, which did involve some ministers, but was largely dominated by the ubiquitous Elon Musk and, of course, the president himself. Sir Keir Starmer may be en route to Washington for his White House meeting, but the focus was on another world leader who is heading to the White House later this week. We'll have more on that in just a moment. But first, this rather notable part of the meeting when the US president talked about the prospect of tariffs on the EU.
We have made a decision, and it'll be 25%, generally speaking, and that'll be on cars and all other things. And they don't accept our cars. They don't accept essentially our farm products. They use all sorts of reasons why not. And now, I love the countries of Europe. I guess I'm from there at some point a long time ago, right? But I love the countries of Europe. I love all countries, frankly, all different. But the European Union's been... It was formed in order to screw the United States. I mean, look, let's be honest. The European Union was formed in order to screw the United States. That's the purpose of it. And they've done a good job of it, but now I'm president.
Well, let's go to Washington and speak to the BBC senior North America correspondent, Gary O'Donoghue. We're used to unvarnished, aren't we, Gary? It was quite an extraordinary meeting, though, this cabinet meeting, wasn't it? Notably, Elon Musk hovering over it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the bit we saw, it's difficult really to describe that as a cabinet meeting because the cabinet said nothing. I mean, for an hour, they said nothing. Elon Musk talked wearing his tech support black T-shirt with white lettering on it, his MAGA hat as well, sort of standing off to the side but kind of looming over the whole thing and really sort of... Donald Trump and him chatting away for this sort of period of time. At one point, because of this question of this controversial email where federal workers have been asked to justify five things they've done in the last week, which has caused a lot of controversy. And many of those people around the table had told their workforces not to respond to. Donald Trump sort of challenged them to say, is anyone unhappy about it? And they all sat on their hands. Now, who knows what happened after the cameras went out? We're told there was a meeting that carried on. But in that bit we saw, it was literally a two-man show, Elon Musk, Donald Trump.
And there was a lot of talk about another leader, of course, who's coming, President Zelensky, Trump conferring he's coming on Friday. What do we know about the deal that appears to have been struck over mineral rights?
Well, we're seeing fragments of it supposedly being leaked. In some places, it's been talked about as a framework. Donald Trump's been sort of talking about this meeting, you know, in terms of, well, if he wants to come here and sign something, that's great. So We'll see what the actual details of it. The crucial thing is whether there's any security guarantees in it for Ukraine. You know, at one point, Donald Trump has said yes to that question. Today, he said no to providing those sorts of security guarantees. So, you know, it's very difficult to know exactly where his position is on this. But he's coming under a lot of pressure and will come under a lot of pressure from Sir Keir Starmer, the Prime Minister, to back any kind of sort of European peacekeeping force that goes in there after a truce is achieved with some sort of air cover or something like that.
He was asked about the peacekeeping force. He said that would be the easiest thing. He said, didn't he, that getting boots on the ground would be easy. The tough thing was striking the deal between Russia and Ukraine.
I think the last 25 years probably tells us that peacekeeping forces aren't the easiest thing, are they? So we'll see how that goes. He doesn't want to be involved in that in terms of the detail and sort of ticked off some of these reporters who wanted to talk about that kind of detail. I will say one thing for our listeners. Bear in mind that in these situations where what's called the pool is now doing these events, where a select group of journalists, you know, TV, radio, online, that is now being chosen by the White House, not by the independent White House Correspondents Association. So the questions you're getting in this context, where it's these sorts of set-piece events with a small number of journalists, are, you know, questions that come through the filter of people who have been chosen to be there by the White House, not by journalists themselves.
Thanks, Gary. Our senior North America correspondent, Gary O'Donoghue, there. So, how should Sir Keir Starmer approach tomorrow's meeting with President Trump? Well, he got some unsolicited advice today from a British politician who knows the American president pretty well. Reform UK's leader, Nigel Farage, told BBC's Look East that the Prime Minister should tell Donald Trump well done on his first month in office, assure him that Sir Keir Starmer is not getting too close to the European Union, and to indicate he's rethinking the deal to hand over the Chagos Islands, which the Trump administration sees as a threat to American security. That's because of the US-UK military base on one of its tropical atolls, Diego Garcia. Well, this evening, the Foreign Secretary David Lammy was asked about the Chagos deal by Robert Peston on ITV.
I still believe it's the best deal.
But does President Trump have a veto?
If President Trump doesn't like the deal will not go forward. And the reason for that is because we have a shared military and intelligence interest with the United States. And of course, they've got to be happy with the deal or there is no deal.
Well, let's discuss tomorrow's meeting, appropriately enough, with a senior British and a senior American diplomat. Sir Mark Lyle Grant was the UK's permanent representative to the UN between 2009 and 2015. He went on to become the National Security Advisor. And Lewis Lukens is US Deputy Chief of Mission here in London from August 2016 until 2019, was acting ambassador in 2017 as well. Gentlemen, welcome to The World Tonight.
James.
Can I start with you, Lewis Lukens? What do you think the impact on this meeting will be as Sir Keir Starmer announcing yesterday that increase in defence spending, which is clearly one of the big asks of Donald Trump?
I think a very positive impact. I think he was very strategic and clever to float that announcement just before he came to Washington. It'll be music to Donald Trump's ears. And I think in whole, I think he was very well advised to do that. And I think Donald Trump expects NATO allies and Europeans and Canada to contribute more of their defense of their budget to defense spending. And I think it was a very smart move by Keir Starmer.
So, Mark, a smart move, but you also, of course, have the challenge of the live news conference. You never quite know, as we've just heard, exactly what Donald Trump's going to say. What do you think the strategy will be of the Prime Minister going into that?
Well, I don't think he'll follow the President Macron strategy, the sort of touchy-feely, hugging and bromance type approach. That's not really Keir Starmer's style, so I don't think he'll do that. But he is going to Washington with a strong hand. I mean, the whole of the bilateral relationship, we are still America's closest ally. As Lewis has said, the defense spending announcement, I think, will have gone down well in the White House. And Keir Starmer's made clear that Britain is prepared to step up in terms of sharing more of the burden of European security, not only in support for Ukraine militarily and financially, but also in terms of actually defending the rest of Europe and relieving some of the burden that's been on the Americans really since the Second World War. So I think he goes with a strong hand, and I expect him to be well received by Donald Trump.
So what about his relationship with Europe? That advice from Nigel Farage, don't get too close to the European Union. I mean, he's clearly playing a role in tandem with people like President Macron. He's coming here for a meeting at the weekend to sort of get a debrief from these meetings with President Trump.
Well, Nigel Farage would say that, of course, because his view on Brexit and the European Union is well known. But clearly, Keir Starmer will want to avoid a sort of binary choice. You're either with America or you're with Europe, because they are both important allies for us. But there's no doubt that President Trump isn't particularly well disposed towards the EU. When I went with Theresa May to the White House during Trump's first administration, he was congratulating the UK on the Brexit referendum. He clearly doesn't like the European Union. You heard a clip just earlier in the programme of him saying that it was formed to, I think, screw the United States, he said. I mean, it's completely untrue, of course. But nonetheless, that's his perception of the European Union. So I don't think we'll see Keir Starmer talking a lot about the European Union, but he will talk about other top leaders like Emmanuel Macron and how Britain and France can jointly help relieve some of the burden on American security.
Lewis, are there any no-nos for this meeting, do you think? Is there anything that Keir Starmer should avoid?
Well, if I were Keir Starmer, I would avoid any difficult or contentious issues. I mean, this is the first time the two men are meeting as leaders. It is an opportunity to develop a relationship, which already seems to be on the right track. I mean, Donald Trump has said nice things about Keir Starmer, and I think Keir Starmer wants to keep that momentum going. And Donald Trump can get very touchy and prickly if people contradict him or if people raise issues with which he doesn't agree. So I would think that Keir Starmer would want to sort of build the relationship and get it to a point where he can later in private talk about difficult issues with Donald Trump. But at this first meeting, I would keep it very general and very sort of happy.
So what about if something has happened during the President Macron meeting happens and he hears something that's he wants to correct? Does he bite his tongue or does he jump in like President Macron did and said, well, actually, that's not right?
Recommend he pull a Macron. I would say bite your tongue and grin and bear it.
Grin and bear it. So, Mark, what broadly speaking, I mean, as a former UN ambassador, I wonder what you thought, for example, of the United States voting with Russia, Belarus, North Korea and others on that third anniversary of Ukraine. Again, is this something that needs to be raised in private?
Well, it's certainly an extraordinary turn of events and really upending American policy over the last 30 years. But I don't think it's something that Keir Starmer would raise in the meeting specifically, because it's just a symptom of the wider sort of Ukraine approach. So I think he'll focus on the key messages on Ukraine about the need for Ukraine's sovereignty to be guaranteed going forward so that they have the policy choice in which direction they want to take the country, and talk about the need for credible security guarantees. Now, how you deliver those two, the sovereignty and the security guarantees, of course, is a matter for debate. But I think those are the key points to get across. But I think he'll also want to say, look, here's a big opportunity for Donald Trump to be the peacemaker. But it needs to be a peace that is sustainable. And for it to be sustainable, it has to have these elements in it. A down and dirty deal will not deliver the sort of win that Donald Trump is looking for.
And briefly, Lewis Lukens, is Donald Trump in listening mode in these meetings? Do you think he's ready to hear messages from people like Keir Starmer?
I'm not sure he is, but I will say one area that Keir Starmer could really focus on, and I think he should, is on trade, right? Donald Trump has been threatening tariffs now for 6 to 7 weeks, and they're sort of off again, on again. But the UK is definitely in the crosshairs if Donald Trump imposes a global tariff. And this is an area where Keir Starmer can really focus on the positive relationship, the strong economic and trade relationship between the US and the UK, and try to, you know, somehow get out of any tariffs which may be coming down the road.
Lewis Lukens, a former US acting ambassador in London, and Sir Mark Lyle Grant, a former UK ambassador to the United Nations. Thank you both very much. Well, let's turn to Elon Musk, the man, as we were hearing from Gary O'Donoghue earlier, was hovering over that cabinet meeting. He was certainly getting some pushback in the last few days to an email that his Doge department sent to all government employees asking them to list five things that they had accomplished in the past week. At that cabinet meeting today, Mr. Musk said the email was a pulse check.
We think there are a number of people on the government payroll who are dead, which is probably why they can't respond. And some people who are not real people, like they're literally fictional individuals that are collecting paychecks. Well, somebody's collecting paychecks on a fictional individual. So we're just literally trying to figure out, are these people real? Are they alive? And can they write an email? Which I think is a reasonable expectation for the American, you know, the American public would have at least that expectation of someone in the public sector.
Well, some of the people who were working for the U.S. government when Donald Trump returned to the White House couldn't reply to the email, not because they were dead or fictional, but because they've already been fired. Ariel Kane was working on a scheme to make childbirth safer in the government agency, which runs the Medicare and Medicaid healthcare programs for older and poorer Americans. And she was one of several members of the team dismissed by DOGE. I asked her how it unfolded.
Our model launched January 1st, and then January 20th, we had the inauguration with the new administration. Immediately, we were given a communications freeze, and the grant money stopped flowing if it hadn't gone out the door already. And then February 15th, I was fired.
You lost your job. Several other people did. Do you still keep in touch with people who are working in your former office?
Yes. I'm still talking with, you know, both people who lost their jobs and people who are still working at the agency I was working at.
And for them, what is life like now?
I think there's two things going on. One is no one feels secure. Everyone is afraid that they're next on the chopping block. I've heard that morale is just in the basement. It's bottom tier.
And who is actually signing off on the firings?
Oh, great question. So it's definitely not our individual managers. I had to call and inform my manager that I got fired. It was coming from the larger HHS agency that CMS is housed within. And I had never heard of the name of the person who was signed off on my termination.
Right. And what about these emails that have been sent out from DOGE to all federal workers?
Yeah.
And the people you know that have got them, what are they doing? Have they replied?
Well, there's been a mix of responses. You know, the guidance at the last minute, the guidance that everyone received was assume a foreign actor is reading your email, because the email inbox that is sending all of these out is actually not a secure email address. But some people responded. I also know, you know, I had friends who received that email who were on maternity leave. I have friends who gave high level summaries of their work. And then I have people who received guidance from their agencies and decided not to respond.
Not to respond. Now, we heard from Elon Musk today at that first cabinet meeting that he is minded to send another email out. I mean, he's saying that he was just taking a pulse check, just to check that there are not, dead souls out there, people who are in posts who don't actually exist.
Well, first of all, many federal employees are not on email. For example, post office workers. It's not a computer-based job. And so the idea that sending an email is the best way to check if people are like sitting at their desks is just not even reflective of the federal workforce. Secondly, we have, you know, agencies and managers and people who evaluate employees' performance on a regular basis. And he didn't even, you know, DOGE is not consulting with any of those folks. There is a way to reform the federal government to get rid of excess bureaucracy. But it involves, you know, doing hard work of figuring out what the choke points are and what laws need to be changed to alleviate those choke points. And he has no interest from his behavior in actually doing the hard work of solving those problems and then building the consensus that is necessary to pass large reform laws. And so to have it all be done, you know, via email just feels like an insult to the professionals doing the work.
How do you feel about all of this?
for myself, you know, I'm mourning a really big loss. I really liked my job. I liked the work I was doing. I felt like I was making a meaningful impact. So that's a personal loss. But I'm also, you know, just worried about the future of our country and democracy, and watching a billionaire run around reforming how the entire federal government works through illegal emails is pretty jarring. And I'm worried about what that means for our democracy and for the federal government and for Americans.
That's one of the fired U.S. federal government workers, Ariel Kane there.
Wir sind Theresa und
Nemo.
Und deshalb sind wir zu Shopify gewechselt.
Die Plattform, die wir vor Shopify verwendet haben, hat regelmäßig Updates gebraucht, die teilweise dazu geführt haben, dass der Shop nicht funktioniert hat.
Endlich macht unser Nemo-Boards-Shop dadurch auch auf den Mobilgeräten eine gute Figur. Und die Illustrationen auf den Boards kommen jetzt viel, viel klarer rüber, was uns ja auch wichtig ist und was unsere Marke auch ausmacht.
Starte deinen Test noch heute für 1 € pro Monat auf shopify.de/radio.
Coming up later, the early medieval and surprisingly unmagical origins of Merlin in Welsh poetry.
Merlin is this figure who presents himself as a bit living away from society in the woods. He's really concerned about the natural setting around him and about humanity's impact upon it. Aminai oif ofnog am gelog am danad. Cagdafodd y coedwyr coed gymuniad I gladdu dwraidd a chlygryd y had fel nethafo fyth a falar.
Well, if you want to know what all that means, do stay tuned. That will be coming up in about 15 minutes. But let's turn now to what is another painful and indeed the final part of the first stage of the Gaza ceasefire deal playing out tonight. But away from the cameras, let's speak to the Israeli journalist Noga Tarnopolsky, who spent the day in Hostages Square in Tel Aviv. Hello, Noga. What is happening? It's more dead hostages this time being returned.
That's right, James. Good evening. What we're seeing right now are images of Red Cross ambulances making their way along very dark roads in Gaza, carrying the caskets of these four hostages. And they are aiming to meet just at the Egypt-Israel border with Israeli military vehicles who will then carry these bodies to the Forensic Institute outside of Tel Aviv.
And what about the Palestinian prisoners? When are they getting released?
Well, if all goes to plan, they will be released the minute or immediately after these bodies cross into Israeli territory, and an initial probe just by Israeli military forensic experts shows that they appear to be the bodies that Hamas said they are. There was a big mix-up last week, or possibly an intentional error, in which the body of hostage Shiri Bibas was sent back to Israel and turned out not to be her, but a Palestinian woman. And so there's a lot of caution and anxiety surrounding this exchange tonight.
And it is the final part of this first phase of the ceasefire deal. Where do things stand as far as it continuing in some form?
Things stand at a complete limbo. It's sort of astonishing when you think that lives depend on it. But we're in week 5 of what was supposed to be a 6-week first phase of this process. And despite hiccups and despite accusations on both sides of acting in bad faith, phase 1 is basically coming to an end tonight, a week early. And negotiations for phase 2, which is a very dramatic phase involving the declared end of the Gaza war, the return of all remaining Israeli hostages, and Israel's complete withdrawal out of Gaza to a perimeter outside of Gaza. All of these discussions were supposed to have started on day 16 of this process. They have not started. That was a decision of the Israeli prime minister, who chose to decapitate his hostage negotiation team. He got rid of the head of the Mossad and the head of the Shin Bet and replaced them with a crony of his right-hand man. And things have been possibly under discussion, but very possibly not as far as we know.
Noga, we have to leave it there. Thank you so much. Noga Tarnopolsky there in Israel. Now, during my university years, Henry Kelly, whose death was announced today at the age of 78, was a familiar and friendly face on the television. Many an essay was put on hold as we crowded around the TV to watch Henry's lunchtime quiz Going for Gold. And of course, on Saturday evenings, he was part of the gang on the prank-filled light entertainment show Game for a Laugh. But the Irishman with the neatly parted hair began his career as a news reporter, including a stint on this programme, The World Tonight. He later returned to radio and to Classic FM.
I suppose you could say that if you've heard one steel band, you've heard them all. But you couldn't say that if you'd seen one corner of the Notting Hill Carnival, you'd seen all of it.
Game for a Laugh, the show where the people are the stars. And the hosts on Game for a Laugh are Henry Kelly. Going for a Laugh.
The heat is on.
The third movement of Brahms's Piano Concerto No. 1 in D minor. Classic FM, it's 4 minutes to 11 o'clock. A winner yesterday, and still I get this type of thing. Dear Henry, I send you this verse. It is brief and concise and perhaps a bit terse. Well, we did have a winner yesterday and we'll go for it.
Henry Kelly there, some of his highlights ending with presenting on Classic FM. It's a path from the World Tonight, Classic FM, others have followed. Now, these days, Petroc Trelawney presents Radio 3's breakfast show, but he worked alongside Henry Kelly when you were a rookie radio broadcaster, Petroc, didn't you? You're with us in the studio. Tell us about him.
Yeah, good evening, James. We were there on day one of Classic FM when it launched in 1992. He was very much the station's big signing. They didn't have a huge amount of money to hire presenters, so they put most of it into Henry. He was the name that everybody knew. And he became synonymous with the station. I don't think he knew a great deal about classical music. He made some great clangers. We all did. But he was much loved, and he had this brilliant ability to make the audience feel they were on a journey of learning about music with him, and he was much loved.
And that progress from, I mean, hard news reporter reporting on the troubles in Northern Ireland to, you know, we heard from a report about the Notting Hill Carnival, but then into light entertainment. I mean, that Saturday night show was huge, wasn't it?
I think he was an enigma to many people around him, and I think he was an enigma to himself as well. I mean, he had this glittering start as a journalist. He was 22 when he joined the Irish Times. He became, 2 years later, their Northern editor based in Belfast. This was in 1970. He had front page bylines practically every day. He came to continue his journalistic career with the BBC, working on The World Tonight. People tipped him as a future editor of the Irish Times. There's no doubt he could have presented big news programmes for the BBC, been a foreign correspondent. But he took this abrupt turn into showbiz with Game for a Laugh. And I think a little bit of him always wondered if he'd sold out by going in that direction, if actually he should have carried on as a serious journalist, at which there's no doubt he was brilliant.
And he loved his sport, didn't he?
He did love his sport. He, particularly racing. I mean, he was
always... You went to the races with him?
I did. We had a Classic FM day out at the races in, I don't know, 1993, probably 1994. We went on the Orient Express to the Grand National. And I don't think I'd been to the races before. He took me down to the bookies by the track and pulled out a wad of cash, which was sort of a centimetre thick of £50 notes. I'd never seen so much money, but he was always happy when placing a bet on the horses. It led to problems later on in his
life. Yeah, he wasn't great with the money, though, was he?
So it is said. That's, yes, I think the money. I think one of the reasons he went into showbiz, or wanted to go into showbiz, partly it was following Terry Wogan and Eamon Andrews, who, of course, had come across the Irish Sea and had great success in the British media. But he loved the lifestyle that came with it. He used to say, I'll never turn anything other than left when I go on board a plane. He liked restaurants. Restaurants with telephone directory, thick wine lists. He liked the kind of showbiz existence, and he liked to be famous as well. And I think he thought, I'm not going to get this out of being a news presenter or a journalist. I can if I present Game for a Laugh with 20 million listeners, you know, every Saturday night from the LWT studios. It was a huge show.
He was a natural as well, wasn't he? I mean, you just got a little flavour of the wit and the warmth.
Yeah, and I think he loved broadcasting. At the end of his career, he didn't want to stop, and the big offers weren't there anymore. He ended up presenting the afternoon show on Radio Berkshire. But for him, that didn't matter. It didn't matter. He'd once had 20 million viewers. Now he was broadcasting to maybe 100,000 people. For him, it was about being on air. It was about communicating. It was about interacting with an audience. That's what he loved, and that's what kept him going day after day.
Well, he was a wonderful broadcaster. Very nice to have your memories of him with us here, Petrarch Trelawney, remembering Henry Kelly, former reporter on this programme, who's died at the age of 78. Now, 3 years into Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine, we know quite a lot about what the Ukrainians think, but it's been much harder to get an understanding of how Russians view the world. A new book that's published tomorrow attempts to do just that, through encounters with a cross-section of Russian society, from pensioners in a dying village to a priest who was close to President Putin to a celebrated but troubled photographer. It's called Russia Starts Here. It's by the British journalist and writer Howard Amos, and it focuses on one of the country's oldest and most deprived regions, Pskov, which sits on the border with NATO and the EU. Now, Howard lived in that region and he returned to it often, most recently in 2023. So I asked him, why call the book Russia Starts Here?
Pskov region was very much where Russia started for me. But I suppose what I always found fascinating about it is that it's, you know, it's, in Russian terms, it's relatively close to Moscow and St. Petersburg. It's right on the border with the EU and NATO. And it's very old Russian land. Like, it's one of the first places where, you know, the Vikings arrived in the 10th century and sort of merged with the Slavic tribes to form the, you know, the Russians. So it's been part of, you know, Russia, the Russian Empire, Soviet Union for, you know, much longer than most bits of Russia. And yet, you know, these days, it's an extremely deprived place, the fastest depopulating region in the country. So I was sort of fascinated by this sort of this juxtaposition between a region in Western Russia, which is kind of left behind, and yet very sort of intrinsic to, you know, Russian history and the country.
And you tell stories of some of those who've been left behind. You start with this couple, the lost ones, the last couple in a village, Nina and Nikolai.
Nina was living in that village when the Nazis arrived, and she remembers the occupation, and she remembers the terrible famine after the war. And she lived most of her life in Leningrad, now St. Petersburg. And then she returned to the village in the 1990s when her and her husband retired. So I was always fascinated by the sort of arc of their lives.
You most recently reported from there in 2023. So this is after the full-scale invasion of Ukraine began. I mean, first of all, what was that like?
It was painful talking to people who I knew very well, like Nina and Nikolai, the old couple who support the war. And I was in Pskov, and, you know, if you walk around the streets, you'd never know there was a war on. There's maybe a few sort of, you know, recruiting posters for the army that you might see. But like very much it was a sort of atmosphere of normalcy, that there was nothing out of the ordinary happening. But then I went to there's a cemetery maybe half an hour's drive from Pskov, which is used by there's a famous paratrooper division associated with the city that's based nearby, which they use the cemetery for their military burials. So I went to this cemetery. There was a funeral going on. They were sort of preparing for the hearse to turn up with the body. But these sort of funerals will be happening every day, every other day, you know, maybe every week. Life on the face of it continues as normal, but then you don't have to go very far under the surface to see, you know, the changes that run away.
One interesting character in the book, and he died, I think, last year, Dima Markov, a very talented photographer, someone who documented daily life in a very original way. Just tell us a bit about him and what his story tells us about modern Russia.
Dima was a friend. As you say, he was a photographer. When I met him, I think he'd only been taking photographs for a few years. He was a very sort of early user of iPhones and Instagram, through which he became very famous. And he'd take photos of his sort of subjects were the marginalized, you know, so people living on the streets, orphans, conscripts. You know, his Russia is not the sort of showcase Russia of, you know, onion domes. He always went to, you know, the sort of edge of Russian cities, these sort of endless fields of apartment blocks, you know, which is very familiar to, the overwhelming majority of Russians. You know, that's where they grew up. That's what they know. He sort of humanized these people and he sort of glamorized them to an extent. I mean, he himself was a heroin addict, which he talked a lot about, and that's where he died of an overdose. But he always used to say that his explanation for why his photos were popular was because everyone came from the sort of Russia that he photographed.
You very deliberately are not telling one single story of Russia. I mean, that's the point of the book, if I'm not mistaken. It's to tell these individual stories, vignettes of personal and oral histories that tell the story of a country that is far more complex than is often portrayed.
That was the idea for the book. That was what I wanted to do. I mean, I worked in Moscow as a journalist for a long time, and I often felt, you know, not the not that what I was writing about was, you know, irrelevant or, you know, unimportant, but, you know, the sort of stories of opposition protests and, you know, big corruption scandals and, or, you know, hackers or spy exchanges, these sorts of things, which are sort of bread and butter of, you know, the news that you hear about Russia usually. I often felt that we were quite divorced from the, you know, the reality that I'd encountered, you know, when I was lucky enough to spend a lot of time in this region. I wanted to try and tell those stories.
Howard Amos, author of Russia Starts Here, which is published tomorrow.
Pockety, pockety, wockety, whack. Abber, abber, and abber, and ack. Shrinking size, very small. We've got to save enough room for all. Higgitus, 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 mug.
The spellbinding words of Merlin, the white-bearded mentor to the young King Arthur in Walt Disney's Sword in the Stone. That is the popular image of Merlin, but scholars who've been studying poems about him in the Welsh language, some of them dating back to the 10th century, have discovered a different, less magic-y side to his character, one that's rather more David Attenborough than David Copperfield. Well, I've been hearing more from another David, David Callender of Cardiff University's School of Welsh, who's been involved in the Merlin Project.
I'd always been interested in Merlin, you know, this worldwide renowned wizard figure. But I was curious about the Welsh tradition of Merlin, because there's this big body of early Welsh poetry and indeed later Welsh poetry in the voice of Merlin. But it's a rather different Merlin from that which you might be familiar with from, say, The Sword in the Stone. Here, Merlin is a poet, a prophet who's prophesying about the future of the island of Britain, and also a wild man living away from society, hiding in the woods.
You say poems in the voice of Merlin. Just to explain that, if you will.
Merlin is presented as a figure from the Old North. That refers to the north of England and southern Scotland back in the 6th century, when people there were still speaking a language something like Welsh, something that we call Brittonic. So that's where Merlin is set. But the poems in his voice that are attributed to Merlin in our medieval Welsh manuscripts are not actually genuine poems of this 6th century figure, rather the products of later poets from the 10th century onwards who chose to use Merlin's voice to examine contemporary concerns, for example, and also record history through prophecy.
Did he exist?
Well, that's an interesting question. I would say that the source base that we have doesn't allow us to prove the existence of Merlin. So we have these traditions that are associated with Merlin from the 9th and 10th centuries, but nothing that quite gets us back to the original 6th century setting.
So the Merlin that comes out through the poetry is more of an environmentalist than a wizard. Just explain, or perhaps maybe quote, because I know you've got some examples with you of the kind of language that you've been able to dig into to get a sense of who he was in this poetry.
Yes, I said that Merlin is a wild man, and he's someone whose sympathy really extends beyond the human. We tend to think of it as quite a modern thing that we might worry about humanity's impact on the natural world, but we find that very strongly. So this is from Merlin's poem To the Apple Tree. Aminai oiv ofnog am gelog am danad. Cagdafodd y coedwyr coed gymyniad i gladdid o raidd a chlygryd y had fel nathaf o fyth a fal arnad. So he's addressing the apple tree and he says, myself, I am fearful, anxious about you, lest the woodman should come, forest hewing, to dig your roots and pollute your seed so that an apple might never grow on you again. So we really see there that Merlin is this figure who presents himself as a bit living away from society in the woods. He's really concerned about the natural setting around him and about humanity's impact upon it.
Where then did the international Merlin come from, if you like, that the wizard figure?
Well, as with so much else, we can thank the wonderful 12th century inventor of stories, Geoffrey of Monmouth, who wrote The History of the Kings of Britain. And this legendary history in Latin was a medieval bestseller. It's one of the most well-recorded medieval works. And in that work, Geoffrey's the first to bring together Arthur and Merlin. And then after that, Merlin becomes part of Arthurian romance in French and in other languages around Europe, and goes on to influence Malory, Tennyson, you know, T.H. White and The Sword in the Stone. So really this wizard figure who's associated with Arthur is someone who ultimately we have Geoffrey of Monmouth to thank for.
setting the record straight in poetry. David Callender of Cardiff University School of Welsh there. A closing headline tonight, Donald Trump has confirmed that President Zelensky of Ukraine will visit the White House on Friday to sign an agreement on sharing Kyiv's mineral resources. That is The World Tonight. This is James Kamara-Sami. For now, from me and everyone on the programme, good night.